This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have part one of Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari's report of his parachute jump, and we have the video to prove it. Our main man, Micah, talks with Bunk and Diana Chase about the Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In coming up in Maine. A proud papa talks with a new Civil Air Patrol cadet, and more on cryogenic hydrogen fuel cells for electric airplanes. In the news, and speaking of hydrogen, an eVTOL with a claimed 400-mile range, the CBS interview with Boeing's CEO, a report on assumptions made during 737 MAX design and certification, and a rather strange story about trapping flight attendants on the plane. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 555 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hello, Max. How are you doing? In fact, I'm wondering, where are you doing it? You mentioned before that you're in a hotel room. Where are we hearing you from today?
That's right. I'm holed up in Baltimore. I'm here for the FAA UAS Symposium, a little three-day affair. This is day one. It's just completed. I think I'll have some observations for this podcast when it's done, and I'll certainly have some for the UAV Digest. David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and co-host, let me introduce you and say hello.
Hello. Now, can I go home now?
No, you got to do a show. But I think you and I will be talking about the FAA UAS Symposium this week. In some detail, you attended last year, and boy, you just raved about it. And I'm having a great experience here this year.
It's definitely intense. So I'm looking forward to your thoughts on everything and see how things have changed or may not have changed over the time that we've been there.
Yeah, that'd be a good conversation to see how the issues have changed in the last 12 months, how the attitudes have changed and all of that when it comes to unmanned aviation. So, but it's been very good so far, and I have two more days to go. So we'll look forward to talking about that in the future. But we've got some aviation news to talk about from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
First up, from newatlas.com, Sky Hydrogen-powered eVTOL air taxi boasts enormous 400-mile range. Well, we've been talking about hydrogen fuel cells a lot lately, both here and at the UAV Digest, that's for sure. But what we have here...
No, you've been talking about fuel cells.
I can't get away from it. And we've got this conversation, and we've got another one coming up later in the show. But this is, I don't know, Alakai Technologies. It's ALAKAI.
Why did they need the apostrophe? I mean, really?
I don't know. It made it feel kind of...
Because it's a traditional letter in Hawaiian.
Yeah, but this is a Massachusetts-based company.
But the word is Hawaiian.
Yeah. Do you know what it means in Hawaiian?
Well, now you're asking difficult questions.
All right. Well,
I only spent 1 week in Hawaii. I know how to spell the words. I don't know how to say them, and I don't know how to translate them.
All right. Well, someone listening, please tell us what the translation of that word is. But this is yet another electric vertical takeoff and landing air taxi company. They're in the news now. They say that the Sky, and that's SKAI, continuing the cuteness of their naming here. They say that it will hold 5 passengers, including a pilot, for up to 4 hours of flight time and 400 miles. And how can they go for 400 miles? Well, there we go. Hydrogen fuel cell again. Power comes from that fuel cell. So, there's so many eVTOL / air taxi / personal transportation / gigantic multi-copter companies out there. I don't know. David, what do you make of all this activity? This is kind of a new kind of aviation coming up here.
I wouldn't call it vaporware, but it is kind of, everybody thinks they've got a shot at doing it. It's kind of like Democratic candidates for the 2020 election. We just get lots and lots of people, and eventually we'll get lots and lots of companies and we'll finally figure out. But what makes this more of a serious game is it's not just the start-offs with vaporware. It's Airbus and Boeing and Embraer and Lockheed Martin and Bell.
Yeah, Bell's here at this conference.
So I don't know if it's the future, but it's a hell of a lot closer to flying cars since us kids with the Jetsons. Mm. But it's sort of that, I don't know, I guess, and I'll defer to my younger compatriot, supersonic transport in the late 60s. Everybody wanted in the game. It didn't happen besides the Concorde and the Tupolev in Russia, but everybody wanted it, you know, and it kind of flows with the increase in UAS activity. But it's an interesting thing because there's a lot of people taking it seriously, and there's a lot of people throwing money at it, you know, and in case of Boeing and Airbus, they're throwing at it in multiple directions. They're not hedging their bets. They're got three or four companies working on the same thing autonomously, excuse the pun. And it seems like that's where we're going. It's like supersonic transport. Everybody wants a slice of the pie and doesn't want to be late to the party. But I don't think everybody knows where the party is yet.
Well, and it was not that different from the VLJs, the very light jets, when they were going to be so many of them flying that they would darken the sky with dentists. So I think we often have predictions that these markets are going to be huge. And then, of course, when you get 100 companies all trying to vie for a portion of the market, 95 of them are gone, and then you're left with five. Kind of reminds me back in 1984 when I was working for the test and measurement portion of Hewlett-Packard. Our group vice president, Bill Terry, at one point spoke, and he said that in the prior year there had been 100 different companies trying to take leadership in the disk drive industry, and all of them were shooting. The goal for all of them was 25% market share, and you can't have 100 companies, you know, attaining 25% market share. The good news is we sold a heck of a lot of test equipment to all those companies as they were ramping up. Bad news is most of them were eventually gone, and that's exactly, I think, what's going to happen in this market as well. But it'd be really interesting to see who succeeds and what design is going to succeed.
Yes. In this particular case, it seems that there's a sole investor behind this, and they've been working on this for four years. So sort of feels like under some degree of secrecy. But it's kind of interesting to think about where the funding comes for these efforts. I mean, David, you were just talking about the major airframers and other large corporations investing in it. We see other much smaller companies trying to develop solutions here. And this one, an example again of just a sole investor that's behind this company. But David, we have a recent example, don't we, of what can happen when there's a sole investor, the spark behind the company, the motivation behind the company, and then that flame goes out and sort of things begin to end. We have an example of that recently, don't we?
Wow, that was a really good transition. A very huge, monumental, stratospheric, back in the end of World War II, a very large eight-engine aircraft flown by a mad but brilliant entrepreneur, engineer by the name of Howard Hughes, flew an aircraft called the H-4 Hercules. For everybody else in this podcast, that's known as the Spruce Goose.
David says that because we were kidding him about the... nobody calls the Spruce Goose the Hercules, a Hercules, except for David. But anyway...
I happen to know my history.
I know.
But last month, that record of that aircraft having the largest wingspan and being the largest aircraft to fly was broken by Paul Allen's Strato launch. Well, on Friday at the end of the month, rumors came out that Strato launch, well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, that shortly after Paul Allen died, the rocket portions of Strato launch that were going to put the satellites and people in orbit, etc., were being phased out. Well, the aircraft is flown and now sits proudly in a hangar, and Strato Launch, the company, is going away and possibly just being dissolved. Another mammoth project driven by one man. You know, what happens when that person dies or gives up? Paul Allen didn't get to see it fly, which is kind of unfortunate, but... What was that?
There's a street noise out here right now. But keep going.
Okay. So, sadly, Strato Launch is gone. We'll have to follow it. It's been rumored. It's not quite official yet, but unfortunate, but it flew, but it's going to go down in history as vaporware.
All right. Well, you know, we can move on to our... our next story. This comes from AOPA, and this is the—I hate to use the word—but the death of something else aviation-related. That I don't know. I'm sort of sad to see it go. But our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, has a report for us.
Last week, Red Bull GmbH announced that the Red Bull Air Races will not continue after the 2019 season, and the 2019 season will only have three remaining races. The championship final races will be held in Kazakhstan, Russia, June 15th and 16th, Lake Balaton, Hungary, July 13th and 14th, and Chubai, Japan, September 7th and 8th. The race began in 2003 with a break in 2011, 2012, and 2013. All the stats and details you'll be able to read at Wikipedia, Flying Magazine, AV Web. I'll be sorry to see the Red Bull Air Races end. I have seen several of the races, the first being in Leipzig, Deutschland, and the last being the championship held in Dallas for the 2018 season. Every one was a great event. Red Bull Aviation, Red Bull Air Races, and the pilots themselves have been friends of this podcast going way back to 2013, where Herr Redmond Reedman, Flight Operations Manager and Chief Pilot for Red Bull Aviation, gave us an exclusive behind-the-scenes tour of Hangar 7 and 8 and Red Bull Aviation facilities in Salzburg, Austria. See episode 280. Red Bull Air Racers like the late Hannes Arch, Patrick Davidson, Martin Shanka, Kirby Chandless, and friend of the podcast, Michael Goulian, have always taken their time for us. It was not just the racers here at the Geeks that we've done interviews with. The airgate master who controls the pylons gave us a great interview. And then we asked for a behind-the-scenes technical interview. And the director of Red Bull Air Races, Jim DeMonto, was made available to us. You can go back and listen to those interviews in episode 533. The part you may not have seen if you've never gone to a Red Bull Air Race was the level of professionalism and the polish that these events had. The seriousness of staff, the professionalism of the staff, the commitment to the event and the venues I have only seen equal to in Formula Ones, which of course are multi-million dollar events. But the Red Bull Air Race had the same equipment, the same FIA officials, and conducted themselves as if this was a multi-million dollar event. To our international listeners, try and get to one of these races. Note, the Japan race is always the most attended event in the Red Bull Air Race calendar, and is a huge event. I personally will miss the Red Bull Air Racers, and I think aviation is going to miss the excitement. I mourn for the loss.
Well, thanks, Launchpad. Yeah, this is kind of sad. And, you know, I had wanted to attend one of the races. It's another example of, you know, if you wait too long, you might miss out.
And I thought I had heard someone at one point in time mention that attendance for these races was not huge, you know, not on the scale of other kinds of events sponsored by Red Bull or on the scale of some of the more traditional air shows. I don't know. I've never been to one. But it looks to me like perhaps this was just kind of a dollar and cents ROI evaluation. The company may have just looked at it and said, you know, this costs a lot, may not be attracting the level of attention that we had hoped. Certainly, I think it has a huge following among pilots, but maybe that was it. Maybe it just didn't have enough following among the general public.
You know, I don't know if, a sponsor may come along that will cause this to be resurrected, or maybe that along with some kind of a redesign of the approach to make it more commercially successful or to, you know, increase the size of the audiences. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, they did take a couple of years off in the past and then came back. Maybe it'll happen again, but maybe not. We'll have to see. All right. Hey, our friend Brian sent in an article. This is from sfgate.com. What Boeing's CEO said on CBS this morning. And it was a CBS interview. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg was interviewed on the television, and he apologized for the crashes. They tried to, you know, elicit an apology from him, and he did pretty straightforwardly, I guess. So I don't know that completely repairs the reputation that Boeing has after the 737 MAX issues, but I don't know. It's a step.
Yeah, I think they need to take a whole lot of steps, and that's just one of many. The whole affair is very unfortunate, but yes, it's always great when you see leaders of companies step up to the plate and, you know, admit their shortcomings. I think that goes a long ways toward getting some credibility back.
Yes, the article here says, and I'll quote, I'll read from this, Boeing and the FAA continue efforts to implement a software fix that corrects the fatal flaws in the 737 MAX's new MCAS technology. And I think I raised this before, but I don't really view this as a software fix that corrects the fatal flaws. I mean, there are a series of issues here, I think, and these are just the ones that we know about. I mean, we see that angle of attack indicators seem to be not the most reliable sensor in the world. Either they're susceptible to bird strikes or other damage. They're apparently very fragile sensors, and so they can get accidentally broken in some way or another. I mean, that's part of this, I think. There's the issue of varying levels of pilot skill. And does an airframer design for the lowest global common denominator or something else? There's the issue of single point of failure on a critical system. I mean, these are all things that, to me anyway, this software, quote, fix doesn't address any of those. I don't know. What do you think, Max? How do you look at this?
Oh, I think it's got to be a lot more than just a software fix. We had a story here sometime in the last week or two in which they were estimating that it would be approximately 150 hours. I don't remember the exact number, but it was somewhere in that ballpark to put each aircraft back in the sky. A software fix doesn't take 150 hours. You know, yeah, the software, you upload it. Yeah, you look at it maybe an hour or two. But this clearly has to be some hardware fixes as well. But I think this transitions into the article on the New York Times that I found a day or two. And it looks to me like the Times has come out with a lot of articles on the 737. So I think they've put a large number of people on this story because we continue to see stories come out from them. And I was really intrigued by the history that they came out with. And it helped to explain, I think, some of the things that you and I were initially just dismayed by, such as single points of failure. Turns out there didn't used to be just a single piece of hardware. In fact, there were multiple sensors, and it wasn't just AOAs, but it was also accelerometers as well. So in the early days of the MCAS system, it was intended to be a solution to really just one problem, and it relied both on the accelerometer as well as the angle of attack indicator. But apparently there came a time where one of the test pilots felt that the stall response was not quite what it should be when you do a recovery from a stall in the 737, and he proposed that the MCAS be expanded in terms of what kinds of capabilities it would address. And in fact, they said they expanded the MCAS to address a full range of stall-type situations. So now instead of it being a solution for one extremely rare event, it became a solution for a much more common event. And in order to get that to work, they had to stop using the accelerometer, apparently, and they did kick back to just using a single AOA. And yet this apparently was, according to the article and the people they interviewed, something that was unknown to virtually everybody that they talked about. So someone somewhere made a decision at some point to just go ahead and use only a single sensor when they decided to expand the range of situations that MCAS was going to be used for. And so folks both at FAA, folks at Boeing alike, all said after this came out, after the crashes, they were all shocked. They had no idea that the hardware in the system had been changed that way. Everybody was pretty much under the assumption that there were multiple sensors involved and that there wasn't this single point of failure that we've been talking about since day one. So it was kind of an interesting chronology to see how this gradually creeped and expanded and got adjusted in a way that put this fatal flaw into the system, which of course is now being reworked.
I think this is one of the best articles I've read to date on the whole 737 MAX issue because they're looking at it kind of holistically or from a root cause kind of standpoint, they being the New York Times. I think they've done a really good job here. And it seems like it's an example of a kind of scope creep, if you will, in an environment where job functions or development functions are highly compartmentalized, right? So, you're responsible for this aspect, you're responsible for that aspect. Somebody makes a change in one of those compartments, maybe optimizing or doing a good thing in that compartment, but the entire, the entire chain was not aware of it, apparently, including the regulators. And so we have this disastrous result. So I don't know if that description of how this development proceeded is unique to this particular aircraft, the 737 MAX, or if it's employed more broadly, and if so, why haven't there been problems there? I mean, that's something to look at. What's different about this case? Is the approach in total different and problematic unless you have some kind of function that looks across the entire process? But it also reminds me of software development, because oftentimes you will have incremental development done, compartmentalized development done, but there's a process by which you you evaluate the entire result as a whole, more than just each particular routine or compartment. So I don't know. Again, I find this a very, very interesting article. If you don't go and look at the show notes for any other purpose, I highly recommend that you guys listening go look for this this link in the show notes. The article title is "Boeing Built Boeing Built Deadly Assumptions into 737 Max Blind to a Late Design Change." I think it's really well done.
Yeah, I agree.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
And if it wasn't bad enough, the New York Times is opening up doors. They reported that the 737 Maxes and the 737 NGs now have critical landing slat failures.
Yeah, some parts. I just read that today, too. I think walking back to the hotel from the symposium, there are apparently a couple, or well, at least one.
The leading edge slat channels are defective.
Right, from a supplier.
It's not just the 737 MAX. It's the 737's NGs before the MAXs. So basically, the current 737 fleet has got to have a stand down to fix these slats. So Boeing is not doing well.
And there's another aspect of this article that I just want to mention. And Max, I agree with you. I think that this is probably one of the best articles I've read, and there have been so many articles written about this. What really makes this good is that they lay out a chronology step by step over time of exactly all the different things that occurred, and suddenly it becomes a lot more understandable of how they got into the situation that they did. But the other aspect that they talked about in the second half of the article was that question that was raised in people's minds about why was the MCAS system not described in the POH. And there was a request that was put forth by the chief technical pilot, Mark Forkner, who emailed the FAA saying, would it be okay to remove MCAS from the pilot's manual? And apparently the officials who were trying to determine the pilot training needs had been briefed on the original MCAS before. And the impression at the time was that the MCAS system was very benign and rarely ever kicked in. Of course, later we know that the design changed and it became, something that could kick in far more frequently. Boeing wanted to limit the changes to the MAX version from previous versions of the 737. And so basically everybody said, yeah, this makes sense. Let's just go ahead and remove this from the manual. It's not necessary. So that was just another piece of how assumptions led to, changes that, after the fact seem, pretty indefensible. But when you look at how the chronology occurred, kind of made sense at the time.
Yes. This really feels like an HBR case study in the future. It really does. Yeah. Well, why don't we move on to another story? This is, a little bit more light than the 737 MAX issue. And this is from the Huffington Post. Delta tried to trap, quote unquote, its own flight attendants on a plane, messages show. So, Max T, this is kind of, I don't know if this is funny or worrisome or what, but it's definitely strange.
Yeah, it's all of those things put together, which is why it caught my attention. I thought, we've got to talk about this. This is just kind of an interesting combination of circumstances. Apparently, there was a Delta flight which was leaving Atlanta going to Toronto, as I recall, which had run into maintenance problems, which was causing a lengthy delay before takeoff. And there were some concerns in the flight operations center that perhaps the flight attendants might reach their duty limits and just kind of walk off the airplane and leave, which I think is probably, what they're entitled to do at that point in time. And so somewhere along the line, a message went out through a new messaging system. And they don't really describe exactly what this messaging system is, but I would have to assume that it's, some type of, app that's easily used on phones, something like Slack or Messenger or some kind of thing like that where operations can communicate with maintenance people and other folks. And basically it told the maintenance people to go ahead and close the door of the airplane and do not open the door, the message read. Flight attendants out of time and none available. The employee advised the gate agents to let maintenance do their work without opening the doors. Thank you. Well, it turns out that they may not have known, but the flight attendants also had access yeah. to this new app that's just been rolled out, and they were able to see these messages that they were essentially being trapped on the airplane so that they couldn't leave. And so as the story continued to roll out, I guess about 45 minutes later, a new message went out that said, okay, if door is not closed by 11 p.m., flight attendants walking, we will most likely have to delay flight until morning if this happens. And then ultimately, I guess after about 3 hours, the flight attendants voluntarily agreed to do the flight, even though I guess it was really going to mess up their day. They were going to end up extremely late, which was going to give them an extremely short night prior to the next day flight. But nonetheless, they kind of stepped up and said, yeah, we'll do this, even though we know that you were trying to trap us and force us to do it. So, you know, you got to admire them stepping up and agreeing to fly the flight, even though, you know, it looks like people were trying to coerce them in, you know, some way prior to that. So, yeah, pretty bizarre story.
Yeah, I agree. I think the flight attendants showed kind of, I don't know, good humor or, you know, dedication to the job or whatever. But Delta says that this is definitely not company protocol to shut the door. I don't know. I guess somebody was trying to do something to make the numbers good or whatever. That's not the way you go about it, clearly. I don't know what Delta will, to do to the poor message writer, the author of these messages, I'm sure this kind of behavior won't be encouraged in the future.
A little bit of retraining. Yeah, I thought that for this entire story, the flight attendants came out as being the only responsible people involved in the entire thing. You know, they basically kind of said, okay, we know there's some weird behavior going, but we're not gonna make a big deal about this. We'll be the adults in the room. And it's, you know, it's great that, you know, people sometimes do that. It's kind of like, fine, we'll put aside your shortcomings and your poor behavior, but we're still going to, do the right thing despite of these strange circumstances.
Right.
So, yeah, pretty wild story. Oh, there was one other little piece, which was that the flight attendants were hoping that as compensation, perhaps on the following day, they would be just assigned a deadhead. So they wouldn't you know, if they're assigned a deadhead leg, then they're basically, you know, flying, but they don't have passengers that they don't have to serve. And that would certainly be appropriate, I think, for someone who had their night shortened, you know, by several hours.
We have a report coming up now from Launchpad Merzari, and this guy went skydiving. That's something that I've never done. I don't really have any great desire to jump out of an airplane, but Launchpad went on a little tandem jump with Skydive Spaceland, and he's got a number of segments here to the story. And what we're going to do is we're going to listen to the first two, an introduction and then a really interesting conversation about what does it take to be certified to do tandem jumps as the instructor. But let's listen to Launchpad's little introduction into his adventure.
A look behind the curtain. I approached our publicist and senior editor. Hey, we haven't done a story about skydiving in 500 episodes. I have a lead on a story. Max says, that's great, Launchpad, but you've got to jump. Wait, what? Look, Max, when I fly, I prefer to be manifested as required crew, not jettisonable cargo. That's not the point, Launchpad. If you don't jump, it won't be a credible story, says Max. Oh, okay, Micah doesn't get assigned these kind of stories. Oh no, you assign him to write on computer software. Well, I'm going to get thrown out of an airplane? Sometimes this just doesn't seem fair. But I guess the show must go on. So off I went to Skydive Spaceland San Marcos. What I found was not one story, but four. The first story, the jumping experience, which is really typified by the video you can see in the show notes. Two, how skydiving works and the rules and procedures for what's involved in jumping and making it safe. 3, the business model and ownership of a skydiving company. And 4, finally, what it's like to fly the jump plane. Overall impressions? This wasn't a small operation. They had 3 or 4 buildings. They even have an on-site cantina. I was impressed with the professionalism, cleanliness, and the open, welcoming environment of the employees and the facility itself. I can honestly say I wasn't scared. The professionalism and explanation of all the procedures calmed any worries I had. The first seconds of acceleration as we exited the airplane did get my attention, but after that, there was no sense of ground rush or acceleration. It was just, at that point, flying. Same when we were under the canopy. Again, it was just flying. And like flying, we practiced a couple of stalls. We did some tight turns. Then we actually set up for landing as if we were an airplane, doing a downwind, a base, a final, and then flaring at the end. I was pretty happy with my landing. To be honest, the thing that startled me the most was when I was flying right seat in the jump plane. All the jumpers congregated in the door, just like you can see in my jump video. But this was worse. All the jumpers gathered in the door, and at 85 knots, all of a sudden, the stall warning horn went off. The plane started to pitch up, and we were going almost full deflection down and yelling for the jumpers to either jump or come forward. Once they departed the airplane, hey, it was back to normal. The plane instantly recovered. After the last jumper had left the plane, we did a wing over, pulled the throttle title, and pointed down at an astounding 35 degrees. I wish I had video for the airplane ride, which was just as exciting as the jump itself, because we ended up with that Cessna Caravan safely on the ground before the last jumper touched down, because fuel is money, and after the last jumper departs the airplane, no one's paying for fuel anymore. I would like to thank Thomas Hughes and the entire team of Skydive Spaceland San Marcos for their gracious hospitality and full access, without which these stories would not have been possible. So let's begin.
All right, before we listen to the next segment here, I'll just mention on the video that Launchpad mentioned, it is a terrific video. The guys did a really nice job on the production. It's really something. And just wait till you see large launch pad and, well, not so large, the guy that strapped the launch pad to him to jump in the tandem. It's just quite a sight. We'll try to get it up on YouTube. I may not be able to do that from the hotel room here. So if you go to the show notes to see the video and it's not there yet, then just wait a few days because I'll get it when I come home. But let's listen to the next part of Launchpad's adventure.
Hello, Airplane Geeks listeners. It's your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And we just completed a skydive here at Skydive Spaceland. And my co-pilot or jump master is
Andrew Leith.
Andrew, we just completed our jump. Pretty exciting from my perspective.
Yes, from mine as well. You know, I've been jumping for 8 years, and no two are the same. It's there's something new about them every time.
Well, let's talk about that. Is there, from your side, is there a CJI certified jump instructor from the FAA?
There is not. Our governing body is the United States Parachute Association. They're the ones that issue the licenses to skydive and the ratings as well to be an instructor. Basically, you've got your coach, AFF, which is Accelerated Free Fall, and your tandem instructor ratings.
Okay, so you go a number of jumps and certifications to get to these levels.
Correct, yes. It's based upon your experience, and obviously there are some prerequisites to gaining any of those instructional ratings.
Is there a medical?
There is. For the tandem rating, it does require a FAA Class 3 medical.
Okay, but for all the other jumpers, there's no medical requirements from the FAA.
That is correct. The only one that requires it is a tandem instructor. That's because you are a pilot in command and someone is, you're responsible for somebody else.
All right. Now, if someone wants to get a skydiving license, what's the path they take?
Well, there are many paths to take to getting a skydiving license, so I'm going to go with what we do here at Spaceland. Basically, it requires you do 2 tandem skydives where you're attached to someone else. On the second one, we give you some more things to do. The way I like to see it is that once you've done one, your awareness is more expanded. You know what to expect. So then we give you some tasks to do on the second one. After you've completed tandem level 2, you are now graduated to the solo program, which is called Skydiver Training Program. And this is basically where you go through a 6-hour ground school. We teach you everything you need to know to make a safe skydive. You go up with an instructor who's holding onto your harness. You do the skydive, except this time you are under the parachute by yourself and you're in control. However, we do give you a radio so that we can talk to you from the ground if we need to.
All right. And how many jumps do you need before you're, you know, out on your own?
It's going to sound crazy, but only 25. So if you put it in perspective, we do about 60 seconds of free fall, right? A whole minute, 25 minutes of free fall and you're licensed to skydive.
All right. So it's 25 jumps. Now, once you get your license, you can just come here and sign up to take a jump, right?
Absolutely. One of the things that we encourage people to do when they're newly licensed is obviously start looking for their own gear, because who wants to rent gear? That is a bit of an investment, but so worth it, because once you have your own gear, you can come here and jump. You can go to another drop zone and jump. That's really the way you're going to gain experience and move up to those other licenses that you get. You know, the basic license at 25 jumps is called an A license. And then after that, you have B, C, and D licenses. And basically, with each of those licenses, it allows you to do more. For instance, you need a B license to be able to do a night jump. Also, the requirement to get your D license is that you've made at least 2 night jumps.
Okay, Andrew. Let's talk about packing and rigging. Do you, what do you got to do to rig your own parachute?
Well, the basic requirements is, as a student, we teach all of them how to pack a main parachute. In fact, that's one of the requirements to get an A license, as well as doing some basic maintenance on your gear. Aside from that, the reserve parachute is the one that requires an FAA certified rigger to inspect and repack. Being that that's your last option, if you have a malfunctioning main, that one has to be packed in a very particular way. The rigger's ticket is just like any airman certificate that you would get, just like a pilot has one. It is a non-aircrew airman certificate. Once you have that certificate, you're allowed to do minor repairs of gear and repack the reserve.
Okay, now the tandem chute we jumped, did you pack that yourself?
No, my job as a tandem instructor is to unpack it. So we have a group of packers that, under the supervision of a certified rigger, are the ones putting the parachutes back in.
All right, and that's done here on location?
Correct. It's done in that backpacking room. We pass through it on our way out to the loading area. So once we're done jumping, we bring the rig back in and lay it down on the floor. And usually in about 10 minutes, it's back ready to go again.
Okay, and the riggers are the only ones who can pack the rental chutes, I take it, also for liability reasons.
If somebody's renting gear, they are perfectly allowed to pack the main themselves if they're using the rig during the day. At the end of the day, though, they will leave it unpacked and have one of our packers repack it.
Once you've got your A license, you can just show up here on a good day and sign up to go up on one of the lifts, I'll call it.
Exactly. Once you're A licensed, you're pretty much licensed. Well, you are licensed to skydive pretty much anywhere. There are restrictions with each license as well, though.
Okay. And is there any restriction on the aircraft you use? I'm thinking helicopters versus hot air balloons versus, you know, the Twin Otter we just jumped out of.
That's a great question. There is no restrictions. Balloons are fun to jump out of. So are helicopters. In fact, at this point, I'll only get in a balloon if I get to jump out of it.
All right. Now, since we're down this path, do you make a difference with base jumping? Is that authorized? Is that, you know, what's the story with that stuff?
Well, base jumping is a discipline in and of itself. The key difference is being that you only have one parachute and a base rig and you're jumping off of a fixed object, right? So that's the difference. You would never be allowed to get in an airplane and make a jump using a base rig. One of the requirements by the FAA is that in order to jump to make a plan to skydive is that you have to have a rig with two parachutes in it.
Okay, well, we'll stay with the FAA, and since this is the Airplane Geeks podcast and not the Cliff podcast. And now to recap our jump, we exited at 14,500 feet. Indicated airspeed was right around 80 knots. But as soon as we exited, the forward airspeed kind of transitions to vertical drop speed.
That is correct. You know, one of the interesting things that people often ask who come out to do a tandem is, does it feel like a roller coaster, right? Do you get that stomach drop? And I have to remind people that no, you don't actually get that, because you're right. We're already moving forward at like 80 to 90 miles an hour. Ground speed is usually higher than that. So the acceleration from that speed to the 120 that we're doing is just not that great to produce that feeling. And so people are usually relieved when I tell them that, and then that's what they experience. So, you know, I often describe it to people as it just feels like a giant wind in your face, which is what it is. It's a very overwhelming experience. And, you know, my job as a tandem instructor is to keep someone calm and excited. You know, I see this as being a peak experience of people's lives, and it brings me great joy to take someone through that journey, doing this for the first time, maybe the only time. You know, it could be a bucket list item, or they get the bug like I did and want to just keep doing it.
All right. Well, we stepped out at 14.5, and then at 6,500 feet, we opened. So we free-falled for 60 seconds. And then how long were we under canopy? I didn't bother to check my watch. I was too busy kind of flying.
Typically, the canopy flight is just 5 to 6 minutes, depending on how quickly we're coming down. Now, obviously, you notice when we did those turns, we accelerated, so we'll lose altitude a little bit faster when we do those kind of those diving turns. But if you're just out there chilling, doing flat turns, you can make the canopy flight last a good, you know, 6-7 minutes.
Right, and when he's saying the turns, we did a couple of steep spiral turns, and just like in the airplane, you exceed 60 degrees of bank, you start pulling 2 G's up to 3 G's, which brings us a good question. What's the canopy rated for?
The canopy is TSO'd for 500. This is not just the canopy, but the entire system is rated for 500 pounds suspended weight. So imagine that the entire weight of right. The gear and you and I together cannot exceed 500 pounds.
And they plan out with including the 3G limit or?
Not so much with the 3G limit. That is simply the weight limit that we've been given for it. I've not heard anything about exceeding any type of G forces. You did feel those G's that we were pulling, which is pretty good, but that's not something that's taken into consideration.
Okay. Well, that's about all I've got. This was really exciting. Thank you for your time, Andrew. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari.
All right. Thanks, Launchpad. And again, we'll have the two remaining segments of his report coming up next episode. Can't wait. But this one was really fascinating, I thought. I really wasn't aware of what the requirements were for being a jump instructor. All right. What's up with the geeks? Max Trescott, what do you have for us?
Well, it's been a tough week in some ways. I lost a client here about 10 days ago, and that's the first time I've ever had a client die in an aircraft accident. So that's, been a little bit tough to deal with. It was not somebody that I taught to fly or taught any of their ratings, but I did used to fly with them about every 3 months just so they could go out and do some instrument practice. A reasonably high-time experienced pilot who did lots of trips to Alaska and Utah. And, you know, you just wouldn't think would get into any kind of accident situation. But he had a 2006 SR-22 that he owned, and he left Moab, Utah on a flight for Henderson to Las Vegas, left around 10:30 in the morning. And according to the FlightAware track, he climbed up to 14,000 feet. Everything looked normal in the climb. Looks like he was climbing a pretty steady 500 feet per minute. Airspeed was pretty constant in the climb. He leveled out, and then for about the next 10 minutes, airspeed was constant, no issues whatsoever. But then for the following 5 minutes, the airspeed dropped total of 60 knots over a period of 5 minutes, while he climbed in that five-minute period about 600 feet, so maybe 100, 125 feet per minute. And the aircraft then pretty much dropped off of the screen. There was no radar hits or ADS-B data gathered, at least on flightaware.com, below 14,000 feet. So it's as if he was there one moment and then gone the next. A friend of mine who's a former research meteorologist looked at some of the charts for the time, and he said that satellite photos, infrared satellite, showed one particular cloud in that area that was up in the 17,000 feet region, and that it also appeared from the cloud phase chart to have super cooled large droplets in the cloud, which are, the kind that are most conducive for freezing. Now, the aircraft was equipped with TKS, but not FIKI, not flight into known icing conditions. And so while it had some anti-icing capability, it's certainly not the full-blown capability that allows you to fly into ice, on purpose, if you will. It's really just meant to give you enough time to escape and evade the ice. So it looks like, based on, some other accidents that have occurred over the years, that perhaps he had a tailplane stall, where instead of the wing stalling, that the tail stalled. And that would actually make sense, because ice tends to form first on small radius type items. So think like antennas and things that are small. And certainly the thickness of the elevator is much less than the thickness of the wing. So you would expect ice would accrete faster on the tail, where unfortunately you're not going to see it. The difference with a tailplane stall versus a normal stall is that the wing provides lift in an upward direction, whereas the tail, the elevator and the horizontal stabilizer, provide a lift in a downward direction. And, those two kind of cancel each other out to, keep the aircraft, pitched properly. And if the tail stalls, the nose is going to pitch down pretty sharply. And if a pilot's not expecting that, they're going to end up being very fast, very quickly, headed down toward the ground. And if they think it's a traditional stall, they're going to do exactly the wrong thing. And in a traditional stall, you lower the nose to increase your airspeed so that you can recover from the stall. Well, if the tailplane stalls, you need to actually pull back to recover, which would be counter to what most people would be, thinking if they encounter a stall. So obviously there's no probable cause or final report. We won't see that probably for at least a year. But there really does seem to be a lot of circumstantial evidence at this point to indicate that it was an icing accident. So not surprisingly, icing was the topic that we focused on last week on the Aviation News Talk podcast. And all I can say is, I hope pilots learn everything they can about icing. And as part of the research for that episode, I got to say I learned a few things about icing that I didn't know as well. Not too much more to say here other than, the first few days were pretty tough, and, certainly I'm feeling better now and headed off to the memorial in a few days. It's not fun to lose somebody you know or you've worked with.
Yeah, it's tragic. Max, what thickness of ice is enough to cause a stall like that?
Good question. I don't know. The professor of meteorology, Fred Reamer from UND, who I had on the show, said that one way to define severe icing is that you accrete a quarter inch of ice or more in less than 5 minutes. And I've heard of people, picking up a quarter of inch of ice before in a Cirrus and, surviving to talk about it. So I'd have to imagine that they picked up more than that. I just don't know how much more. The climb tells me that probably he was trying to climb, above the cloud that he'd entered to escape the icing. In hindsight, a U-turn probably would have made a lot more sense. If he was in an area with no icing, entered in the cloud and picked up severe ice, then probably, could have made a U-turn and gotten out of it, relatively soon. But I think that's a challenge. I think that going into a cloud, often we're optimistic and we think, ah, we'll be out of it soon. It's not that big. And it's really, it's kind of misleading. You know, when you come up to a cloud, it's easy to kind of go, okay, this looks like a small cloud. I'll be out of it in a minute. And I have found that invariably my estimates are wrong by a large margin, and clouds tend to be much larger than they appear when you, you know, come up on the side of them. And, you know, maybe he thought that, you know, climbing was going to work for him. I don't know whether or not he had oxygen on board. I know the airplane was not equipped with oxygen. It's possible he had a tank with him. But that would probably be the reason he was at 14,000, because that's the maximum altitude you can be at for up to 30 minutes without having to have oxygen. So once he started to pick up ice, he may have been reluctant to climb to a higher altitude, knowing that he'd be violating the oxygen rules. But boy, I would say that that would definitely be a time to break that rule if you're facing, you know, severe icing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very sad. Obviously, you know, condolences to his family and his friends as well. All right, we have a piece from our main man, Micah. And let me set this up a little bit. This is about Bunk and Diana Chase. And they live a true airplane geek life. In the summer, they live in a beautiful home right next to the Lymington Harmon Airport in Lymington, Maine. Then in the winter, they move on down to Lakeland, Florida, where Bunk volunteers at the Central Florida Aerospace Academy and Diana works with Sun and Fun Media. Well, Bunk and Diana are also part of the original group to start the Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In that Micah has talked about. We've had a guest as well. But Bunk's personal hangar in Maine, it opens right up on the AirNav 63B runway 1129, and in it he has two Pitts specials, one of which, N6W, was built by Curtis Pitts himself for Mary Gaffney, one of the world's greatest aerobatic pilots. And also in that hangar is perhaps the most beautiful Piper Cub ever seen. Now, Bunk and Diana invited Micah into their home to talk a bit about this year's fly-in, which will take place on July 14th, 2019. So let's listen to the conversation.
It's your main man, Micah, here in Lymington, Maine, with Bunk and Diana Chase, two people that actually started the Spurwink Farm's Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In, which will be happening again very soon on July 14th. Bunk, Diana, thank you so much for inviting me to your home and talking to me about this great event.
Well, as far as the fly-in goes, Mary Lou called us up one day.
And that's Mary Lou Sprague, yes, who owns the farm out there in Spurwink.
Yeah, that's Vinny's wife, Vinny's wife. And she asked me if I could get a few guys together to come down and do a flyby and maybe land at the airport on Finney's birthday, because he just loved airplanes so much. And at the time, he wasn't flying anymore, you know, because he was starting to get pretty elderly at that time, as long ago as that was. But so I said, well, geez, I'd love to do that. How about if we bring our grills and pancakes and everything else, and we'll set up and have a great big pancake breakfast for you right there.
And when was that? About how long ago?
I'm trying to think, but it's around 93 to 94.
Wow.
And the reason I say that is when he first, or she first called me for that birthday party thing, I thought that was over. You know, I thought that would be the last thing time we'd do that. And we all went home happy because we had such a great time and we made some money for our chapter on the pancake breakfast and everything. And believe it or not, next year, Finney called me, and he said, geez, that was so much fun last year. And all my family came out and visited, people that we hadn't seen for a long time. And would you do that again this summer? And he picked the date, and we did it again that summer.
And so people who are listening, and we have listeners from all over the world, the Spurwink Farm is in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, and it's right on the coast. And it's what up here in Maine you would call a saltwater farm, because exactly, it's yes, right there on the edge of the ocean, and it's absolutely beautiful. And it also has a beautiful grass strip on it. So let's just ask this to start with. It's the event, and we'll talk about the event a little bit more. It's July 14th this year, Sunday.
Yes.
And if people were to be coming to fly in, how would they find that field? What is it called?
Well, it's a private airstrip, and it's not on the chart. But it's called Spurwink Farm, and we call it the Spurwink Fly-In. We post on our poster, we put in coordinates to find it on your GPS when you fly in. You can call Portland Tower, and they know exactly where it is and what's going on, and they can direct you there if you don't have any other way to find it.
And if people want to find out more about it, obviously, there's the EAA Chapter 141 Facebook page, and it will always be posted there. So back around 93 and 94, you kind of had a breakfast cookout out there.
Yeah, we hit it twice, and then I think it was the third time that Finney asked me to come down there. He said, why don't we make this an annual thing? So we actually started counting either at that third point or the fourth one. We started to count it, and we came up with 25 years so far. But in reality, it's been more than that, a few years more. Mm-hmm. But it's been made official, you know, since about the mid-90s.
Well, it's a fabulous event, and I was fortunate enough to meet you there last year, and you flew in from here in Leamington, and you fly a Carbon Cub, if I remember.
No, I fly a Originals, the 47 J3 Cub.
A 47 J3
46.
Cub? 46. 46 J3 Cub. And if I remember correctly, I haven't seen it since October, when it was a rainy day like this, but it's a beautiful golden color, isn't it?
It's yellow.
Yeah,
it's a golden yellow. It's really beautiful. I changed the color just slightly from the original Cub color. I didn't use the color number out of the book for the Cub yellow because I just wanted mine to be a little bit brighter yellow. A few things that I did to it are not original. Somebody walking by that seen J3 Cubs and stuff would never realize it, but I flew to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania for the Cub fly-in. Boy, did I get a lot of crap for things I did to that. But everything that I did to it, I think, was just an improvement more than a modification. Minor things like I put carpet on the floorboard, and that makes it a whole much easier to vacuum up the dirt and dust and sand and all that stuff.
Oh, sure.
Because they just had plywood floorboards, and when you're sitting on the ground, there's quite a slope to that, and all the dirt runs right back in the tail of your airplane. So that's one of the reasons I did that, and other minor things like that.
You always want to modernize a little bit, you know, but it's a beautiful, beautiful airplane. And frankly,
I hear that from everyone.
With that color, I assumed it was brand new, but it's a 1946.
Well, the paint is brand new. At least it's 7 or 8 years old now, I think.
So, Diana, how did you end up getting involved in the fly-in?
Oh, okay. Well, I started getting involved in EAA chapter because we live here at the airport where the chapter we moved to in the early 90s. We moved into the Spurwink to up here, and we were managing the airport at the time too.
And Diana and I are not founders of the EAA chapter.
No. Okay.
We are members that decided to move the EAA chapter here to this airport.
Okay.
So the chapter was formed in 1963 in Sanford, Maine.
So, and we started having the regular pancake breakfast the first Sunday of every month all through the 90s. And so I was just there, and I wasn't even an official member yet, but I just got involved with helping put on the pancake breakfast, and we do a poker run. And we had several other fly-in events that were real fly-ins with skydivers and the fire department and setting up different things, you know, things for the kids.
We had food vendors here and everything. It was a lot of fun.
Raffles and so forth. So that's how I get involved. I was right there. We live on the airport. We were working across the runway. Pretty easy to get to work. You just cross the runway. It's right there at the FBO.
Well, so, sure. Well, I remember for the October fly-in, unfortunately, we had a little bit of a rain out. It wasn't quite perfect, but Bunk, you said, I'm not coming to a fly-in by walking. And you have, you for an airplane geek, you have the most perfect home because your hangar is right on the runway. You are right on the runway. You took off in your beautiful Cub, went around a pattern, and landed on the other side of the field.
Well, as to add to Diana's part of this thing, back in those days, we did not have very many members, just a handful of members. And it was very hard to get the members to come and help us with things. Mm-hmm. So that's why Diana, she said she wasn't even a member yet. She just came over and helped us set up and cook and so forth and so on and so forth. So she was a great help to help us get this thing started.
Well, this fly-in on Sunday, July 14th, which also happens to be Bastille Day for those of us listening in France, is actually a special fly-in because we talked about you and Phineas Sprague, Mr. Sprague, who unfortunately left us this year. So this is the first fly-in we're going to be having without him. I suspect it's going to be a really big celebration of his life. Are there any special plans?
There are special plans for Saturday the 13th, and they're going to have the celebration of life for him that day with his family and friends and all that. It's not going to be right there at the airport, but it's so that's his celebration of life. And then, of course, we'll probably make some mention of, let people know what has happened and what's going on, and that we're going to continue this thing. And on Saturday, they're going to have John Apt down in Biddeford tow a banner over.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that'll be quite a nice celebration. Mary Lou has not given a lot of thought to that.
One of the things that happened last year, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it, Mr. Sprague wasn't particularly mobile in his last few years, and he came through to see all the aircraft on his golf cart. And a good friend of the show, Ernie Eaton, who flies a Robinson R-22 helicopter out of Sanford, was there, and he was just getting ready to leave, and he was just prepping the aircraft to take off, but Mr. Sprague saw it, and he said he'd never flown in a helicopter before, and Ernie said, well, we can't let that happen, and made an extra special run, helped Mr. Sprague get into the helicopter, and took him for a ride, and that makes it even more special because it was his first and only ride in a rotary wing aircraft. And how wonderful that the biggest pancake breakfast and flying that ever happened, we had over 100 planes, that Finn was able to fly in a helicopter for his first time.
It was, and it was a great thrill to him. He talked about it to Mary Lou, and she told me how much he liked it.
It's great.
His helicopter ride.
Last year was the most perfect day that we could possibly have had for the fly-in, and we can only hope that this year it's just gorgeous. I got a little sunburned, but what's beautiful about the fly-in that many people don't realize, it's a great family event because not only is Civil Air Patrol there, which is a bunch of kids, but a lot of kids attend, and if you want to, it runs from 8 in the morning till about 2 in the afternoon, and the airfield is right off a couple of beaches. So if you can bring your kids in the morning,
you can beach right around the corner. Yeah.
Hit the beach in the afternoon. It's a perfect all-day event if you want to just drive in. And obviously, if you want to fly in, boy, what a gorgeous sight.
It sure is. Almost every day there's morning fog. And sometimes we just can't get going very early in the morning because of that fog. But it blows out, and then we have days like last year. And we've had a lot of days like that, believe it or not. And we've just been so lucky.
Absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. Bunk, Diana, thank you so much for inviting me to your home and letting us talk a little bit about the fly-in. And I hope that we get maybe 150 planes this year. Let's see what we can do.
I don't know where we'll put them. It would be nice, but, the fly-in is just growing so fast that we're just going to run out of room, that's all. I don't know what we can do about it as far as... I think way down at the far end, right about where the dog leg is, we may be able to park a little more airplane, double park them down there. So put a few.
So maybe we shouldn't tell the folks that it's probably the only pancake breakfast where you're going to get really true Maine maple syrup.
Yes, donated every year by Phineas.
People really comment on that.
Yes, pure maple syrup.
But what surprises me is a lot of people will ask for the Aunt Jemima. Maple. I can't figure that out.
Obviously, they're not from up here.
No, that's for sure.
Not used to it. It's very strong because it's pure. So,
and not quite as sweet, but boy, is it delicious. And, you know, maple syrup in airplanes, how much better can it be?
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yes. Thanks for coming to visit.
Nice to chat with you.
All right. Thanks for that, Micah. One more interview. Actually, this is a little bit of a different sort, and this is very short. This came from Aaron, and Aaron posted a picture in our Slack team a couple of months ago about his daughter getting her first rank as a Civil Air Patrol cadet. And we suggested that he, well, maybe get a little interview with her, and we played on the podcast. So he worked on that. And he sent this along. Listen to this.
Hey, airplane geeks. Aaron from Stick Stories Scotch here. And today I've got a very special interview for you with Cadet Airman Giddings. She's going to tell us a little bit more about why she joined the Civil Air Patrol. So, Cadet Airman, first question, why did you join the Civil Air Patrol?
I joined the Civil Air Patrol to help people and help make our country a better nation.
And where did you first hear about Civil Air Patrol?
I heard about the Civil Air Patrol 3 years ago when I was at a air show at a Civil Air Patrol recruiting booth.
Okay, very good. And how long have you been in so far?
I've been in the Civil Air Patrol for about 2 months.
And what's your favorite thing that you've done so far?
My favorite thing that I've done so far in the Civil Air Patrol would probably be the emergency services training, because it helps me to be prepared to go on an actual mission and help search for people or missing planes, hikers, take your pick.
Cool. And what are you most looking forward to come yet in your first year?
What I'm most looking forward to is, like, training myself in the first year, and, like, in the second year, like, putting all that training to good use.
And what would you tell other kids and teenagers who are thinking about joining the Civil Air Patrol?
I would tell them that it's a great opportunity to learn more about aerospace, to get a better education, and if they're thinking about going into the Army or Air Force, they can give scholarships for that. They can give you flight training too, so it'll help you become a better pilot. So I just strongly suggest it. It could also help you become a better member of the state you're in.
So you also got the chance to have your first orientation flight recently. How'd you like that?
Well, at first I was a little scared going in the air. It felt pretty new, even though I'd done it like months before. But it was really fun. I got to fly the plane myself. We had these headphones, and we got to talk to each other through the radio. And we heard other radio chatter from the airport control, and it was pretty fun.
So you're looking forward to more flights then?
Oh, definitely. Once you get in the air, you have to go back up there.
Couldn't agree with you more on that one. All right. Thanks, Cadet. Have a good night.
You too, sir.
Hey, airplane geeks. One quick disclaimer I should probably put at that interview. Cadet Airman Giddings is, in fact, my daughter. I am very proud of her. And I'm thrilled to be able to have a little interview with her. She is very much enjoying the Civil Air Patrol. And if you have kids in that kind of preteen to teenage range, it's definitely something well worth checking out. She even got me to join, which admittedly, spend time with my daughter and get to hang around airplanes was a real arm twist for this airplane geek. And, of course, you can listen to someone who's spent a whole lot more time in the Civil Air Patrol than I have on one of the recent Airplane Geeks podcast episodes. So definitely check that out. He tells it a lot better than I do. Thanks for listening. This is Aaron from Stick Stories Scotch, and remember, till next time, keep your knees in the breeze.
I think that's awfully cute. You can find Aaron's website, Stick Stories Scotch. It's actually sticks-stories-scotch.com. Take a look at that, and really love that interview with your daughter, Aaron. And yeah, good luck with the Civil Air Patrol. All right, a little bit of listener mail. We heard from Jeremy. Now, Jeremy sent a photo to us. I don't know. This may be a kind of a photo that David could help us with. Maybe not. I don't know.
Oh, we've already seen the answer.
We have? Okay, well, let me
see. That's right.
I haven't seen the answer yet. Let me say.
I'll tell you what it is. Go ahead and read the story, and I'll tell you the answer.
All right. So Jeremy writes, I had the chance to visit the great Air and Space Museum at Paris Le Bourget Airport. Absolutely wonderful airplanes prototype section. It happens to be right next to where the Paris Air Show will take place in 3 weeks. Now he says, I found this covered airplane rather mysterious. What is hiding under that canopy? I thought I would send it to you guys and see if you could find out what it was. A secret new airplane? I doubt it, but probably something cool. So, did I post this in the Slack team? Is that where I did that?
So you sent out an email to the co-host here.
Oh, that's right.
And I certainly didn't know the answer, but Launchpad came back last night with an answer and a photograph. He says it's the new Boeing TX trainer. And he said that he's also asked Boeing for some time while he's at the show. So I guess he'll be at that show as well. Good looking airplane. And I would have to say that the only thing that's really, you know, visible in the photo, which is of an airplane underneath a white sheet, if you will, a white yeah. cover, is a little bit of a square looking inlet for an engine on the side of an aircraft. And yeah, that kind of looks like it matches up with this TX trainer. So I think Launchpad may have identified it. So kudos to him.
Yeah, good for him. All right. Yeah, and he'll be going to the Paris Air Show, getting some interviews for us. We're looking forward to those. We also heard from Patrick Wiggins. He sent in a piece, a report, airlines installing uncomfortable bumps in seat backs because it pleases them. This is from The Onion. It's if you're not familiar with The Onion, some of the best humor I think around comes from The Onion. This is not a new story, but it's pretty entertaining nonetheless. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And then Neil sent us a link. Air New Zealand spends billions buying new fleet of Boeing Dreamliner long-haul jets. And Air New Zealand has apparently ordered 8 firm Boeing 787-10 Dreamliners, options for 12 more. And according to the article, it says that these are going to replace the Air New Zealand 777-200s that they have. And interestingly, the Dreamliners have a 25% better fuel burn, which, of course, is significant. And these planes are scheduled to arrive in 2022. And I got to say, David, do you like the Air New Zealand livery as much as I do? I've always just found this design to be kind of spectacular.
Eh.
Not impressed, huh?
Give me orange trim on DC-3s or constellations with full-size eagle heads that go down the fuselage. Old-school liveries. Although, of the new ones, Air New Zealand's all-black ones are good. But these days, liveries are just boring. And watching all of the airline geeks geek out over another white airplane with one sheet line is just not my cup of tea.
Okay. Maybe we should, I don't know, do you have any artistic talent, David? Would you be able to sort of draw your ideal airplane livery, or is that something that's never going to happen?
I could draw my ideal go look Eastern Airlines Constellation and look at that logo from the mid-50s. There's an ideal one. or American Airlines on a DC-3. American Airlines, yo, people, your color should be orange.
Okay.
That not red, white, and blue or white. It was natural metal and orange.
Yeah, originally.
Or there's nothing more perfect than a Boeing 707 with silver, white, and a blue globe with the words Pan Am on it.
Yeah.
Those are liveries.
Yeah.
What we got these days are just spray paints. Though I do like the A&A A380 turtle, as well as A&A's R2D2, C3PO, and BB-8 markings.
Yes.
But they're one of a kind. They're not liveries.
Right.
They're
right.
Just one offs.
Yeah. A&A loves those theme. Yeah, like you say, one off theme paint jobs. But yeah, I don't know. I'd like the Air New Zealand one.
Well, when you get one, David, let's start the Airplane Geeks airline because I'm ready. I'm thinking, I haven't lost much money yet this year, so you know it's a good way to lose some. Let's start an airline.
Here's something that drives me bonkers. Like British Airways, to celebrate their history, has a bunch of retro jets, and everybody goes, "Wow, isn't that an amazing livery?" Yeah, it's like it was so good they decided to cancel it. You know, airlines change, and United's a good example of this. They change for the sake of change. You know, branding is brand. Okay, and this is the marketer universe, right? Every so often you get a new management, and the management goes, "We've got to change their branding." Now, they don't want to change their branding too far, but they want to make a change. So what happens is they don't go big and go home. They go subtle and boring.
I get your logic.
I mean, it's if you're going to change. I mean, if you feel the obligation to change your branding and your branding is that bad, then change. Now, otherwise, you know what? It's pretty good, and a lot of people like it, you know? There's nothing better than United Airlines tulips on 747s, you know? And look at United today. It's like, ugh. Euro white, ugh. I don't mean to be on a rant, but I also want people to know that I do pay attention. It's not like I'm talking about something else. Yeah, you know, the worst thing I ever thought Southwest did was the heart, which meant so much to them, on the side of their door, right when you walked by the when you walked aboard the airplane. They slapped it on the bottom of the fuselage. You know, and it's like, okay, is that really where you want it to be, on the bottom of the fuselage?
Same.
And they're like, well, you can see it up in the sky. It's like, no, I mean, you're taking
something
that represented something to you, and you're...
That's funny. Yeah. Hey, I wanted to tie two things together here. You brought up in the conversation here both the 787 and the A380. Do you recall a couple of weeks ago we had a news story in which we talked about the A380 and how the first two were being scrapped for parts?
Right. Yep.
And we did get a couple messages from people who called us out and said, hey, the same thing happened with the 787, though I think it was just the first one. Anyway, I guess their point was that...
Well, the first 787 is in a museum now.
Well, maybe it was the second one.
But, I mean, you know, and... It's the same logic that people give when the Air Force is setting up an aggressor squadron with F-35s. And they're using pre-production aircraft or low-rate production aircraft to fill that squadron. And they're like, well, why can't you make them up to standard level? It's like, it's a pre-production aircraft. It's designed for testing. It's designed for learning. It's not designed for combat. You know, and pre-production airframes like A380s and 787s, how many Dreamliners got grounded because of the battery packs, you know, and they had already moved on to the bigger, they'd move on from the original 787s on to 787-9s or 787-10s, you know, and that's what the airlines really wanted. So now then they were left with the 787-8s. So they get used for parts, you know. It's all the nature of the system, you know. Things change over time. You know, if half of these 737 MAXs don't ever get back in the air, guess what, folks? They're going to be used for parts because they're more valuable as parts than they are as an airframe sitting in the desert. That's why we have all of these desert places, you know. Sorry, boy, did I go off on a tangent. Boy, did you set me off, Max.
This is like the grumpy David segment.
And I meant to bring up tankers too.
No, yeah. Okay.
And maybe the A-10 would work well with tankers. No, I'm just kidding.
But, you know, on that Dreamliner, though, wasn't the idea to use that for patches, right? When you do a carbon fiber repair, it's not like doing an aluminum repair. You know, you've got to basically take an original, you know, fuselage barrel or whatever and cut that out and then, you know, use that as a patch. You can't just you can't manufacture a carbon fiber patch to some, you know, random size. I thought that's what they used that you know, that early Dreamliner or two for, but maybe I'm remembering wrong. All right, so let's push on. I want to talk about hydrogen fuel cells.
Boy. Okay, I'm going to go back to sleep now.
All right. David's going to take a nap. So this is from our listener, Sam Abelsamid, who you may recall is a Navigant Research senior analyst and major car guy. So I found this really interesting. He says, listening to the latest show, I wanted to chime in on cryogenic hydrogen. This is where we were talking about, you know, typically hydrogen used for fuel cells is in a compressed tank. And we were talking about using cryogenic hydrogen or liquid hydrogen to feed the fuel cell. So Sam says, fuel cells are a great mechanism for producing electricity on the go in an environmentally friendly way. As you mentioned, a fuel cell takes in oxygen and hydrogen, which are combined as they cross catalyst plates to form water and electricity. There are several vehicles now available in California that use hydrogen fuel cells for electric propulsion. The Toyota Mirai and the Honda Clarity and the Hyundai Nexo. And I hadn't heard of any of those. Sam has a video that it's up on YouTube, and you'll be able to watch that right in the show notes. And this is from the new Screensavers show on Twit. And it's a review of the Honda Clarity fuel cell vehicle with Megan Maroney. Now, Sam says, these all use compressed hydrogen gas at 700 bar pressure. In the past, BMW has experimented with liquid hydrogen to power an internal combustion engine and had a fleet of prototype 7 Series sedans in the late 2000s. Now, even compressed at 700 bar, which he says is 10,000 PSI, gaseous hydrogen has an energy density of about 1.4 kilowatt hours per liter. Liquid hydrogen has a density of 2.3 kilowatt hours per liter, making it better suited to applications where long range and max fuel load is needed, such as spacecraft or airplanes. So he says, so why not just use liquid H2 all the time? Well, when you put gaseous H2 into a high-pressure tank, it stays there. Liquid hydrogen needs to be kept at minus 423.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Because it is liquid, it doesn't need a high-pressure tank, but it needs to be heavily insulated. Even with significant insulation, there is still some heat transfer, and the liquid in the tank will warm up and vaporize. This gets to what David was talking about, I think. Because these cryogenic tanks are not designed for pressure, the gaseous H2 needs to be vented off. This is why BMW abandoned its experiments. If you left the car parked for a week, the whole tank of H2 would boil off, making it impractical for a car fuel. This is why everyone uses compressed gas in cars. However, Sam says, an aircraft is generally not sitting idle for long periods. You fuel it up and fly it off. So boil off is not really an issue for this application. Plus, the temperatures at 35 to 40,000 feet altitude help reduce heat transfer. The added energy density means you need a smaller volume of fuel to travel a given distance, although the mass is the same. And then Sam finishes, for David, the need to keep liquid H2 so cold means that you won't simply be repurposing the existing jet fuel tanks for these electric birds. For Max T, modern H2 storage systems are far more reliable and robust than a 1930s gas bag, so I don't think these would be any more dangerous than an oil-burning aircraft. So thanks to Sam for that. You can find Sam in a lot of places online. His website is sam.abelsamid.com. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. But you can also find him on Forbes, some other publications, wheelbearings.medium, of course, at Navigant Research, and a few other places. So we'll have some links to Sam in the show notes. Want to thank him for providing that information that really kind of fills in some questions about hydrogen fuel cells as used in aircraft.
Oh, I agree. I definitely want to thank him as well, too, because I think his email was extremely well laid out and made it very clear. So thanks for taking the time to write that. I certainly learned from that. I did want to mention that I'm familiar with the Toyota Mirai. I actually looked at it back in the December-January timeframe. I was looking to get a new car, and the local Toyota dealership was saying, hey, you really need to look at this car, and you know, we've got all kinds of great incentives on it and so on. And a couple of things I found interesting. One, the range was a little bit limited. I had a trip that I was contemplating that I might be making on a regular basis that was going to be at least from a round trip basis over 200 miles out of range of the nearest hydrogen pump. And unfortunately, that was just going to cut it a little too close and wouldn't make it feasible for the trips I was looking to do. You do have to take a look. There was an online map that gave you the locations of all the hydrogen fuel stations. And if you stay in the metro areas, there are plenty of them. But once you head out into the Central Valley of California, they're very far and few between, which is why it wouldn't work for something that I thought I might be doing this year on a regular basis. They were offering, I think, as an incentive with the car, I believe it was 3 years worth of free fuel. Maybe it was 60,000 miles. I can't remember, but it was somewhere in that neighborhood. But then what I found out was that once you start paying for the fuel on your own, it was relatively expensive. My recollection, and I could be off on this, was that the cost to fill the car was going to be somewhere around $75 for a tank. And as I recall, a tank would do a little over 200 miles, maybe 220. So, you know, on a cost per mile basis, it was somewhat more expensive. Of course, you'd have to, you know, factor in the first 3 years of free fuel and so on. But yeah, this may indeed be something that we see more and more of in the future. I think that right now, the economics are such that the car companies are probably having to use a lot of incentives to move the cars, because I don't think they're quite penciling out as being as economical as some of the alternatives. But it's certainly an interesting wave for the future.
Yeah, it definitely is. Sam touches on the cost issue and the availability of hydrogen for automotive use as well in that video that we'll have in the show notes. So it's kind of an interesting piece. I think everybody will find that interesting. All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you for listening. And as always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/555. That's the episode number. And if you want to reach us via email, you can write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. As you can tell, if you haven't figured out by now, we love recordings from you. You can even interview your kid. We love having that stuff. So you know, feel free to send us along some recordings. You don't have to wait to a bits and pieces episode. That's typically where we have a lot of them, but you don't have to wait. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. And Max Trescott, we'll start with you.
Well, they can find me where I usually hang out, which is at aviationnewstalk.com. That's a show that I do every week all about general aviation. So if you're interested in aircraft that are kind of fill the void between commercial and military, pretty much everything else is general aviation. And that's also the place where you can click on contact at the top of the page and send me an email. Always love feedback for use on the show. We get lots of them. And also there's a tab up there where you can click on listener questions. You can actually record a question, which I will then use on the show.
You know, David, there used to be a show that John C. Dvorak did, and I bet Sam will remember this. It was called Cranky Geeks. And I actually have a Cranky Geek t-shirt that I get a lot of positive comments from, a lot of laughs, actually. I don't know, David, I don't think it would fit you. Otherwise, I'd maybe suggest donating my Cranky Geek shirt to you, but in honor of this episode. But otherwise, where do folks find you online?
Well, I suddenly feel like I should tender my resignation.
No.
What was the question?
Yeah, where do we find you online, David?
You can find me on DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Slack listener team, and you can join that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll open up the back door and let you in. Or you can find me on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Or you can find me on the UAV Digest on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones and fuel cells or automotive cars that fly or fuel cells. Or this week
with the FAA.
or in this case, this week, the FAA and fuel cells. So with that, where do we find you, Max?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me, as David said, at theuavdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience at paxxpodcast.com. And if that isn't enough and you'd like to send me an email, you can send it to maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions at incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. And we'll ask that you all join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments, we shall be landing. Kindly observe.